Readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, who, in honor of St. Patrick's Day, has researched a show all about modern Irish literature. Of course, we're all familiar with classic Irish authors, James Joyce, Oscar Wilde, George Bernard Shaw, Samuel Beckett. You know, I hadn't even realized that Bram Stoker of Dracula fame was Irish. But today, we take a more contemporary look. Aye, it'll be grand, as we turn to page one of the book report. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. Brooklyn is one of Colm Tóibín's most celebrated novels. In the early 1950s, Eyeless Lacey cannot find work in her small Irish hometown. When offered a job in America, it's clear she must go. Eyeless heads for unfamiliar Brooklyn and lands in a crowded boarding house where the manners and morals of single women are under constant scrutiny. She works in a shop, attends night classes at Brooklyn College, and on Fridays enjoys dances at the parish hall. Slowly, the pain of parting is buried beneath the rhythms of her new life. She begins to find a sort of happiness. As she falls in love, news comes from home that forces her back to Ireland. She finds challenges there that conflict deeply with the life she's left behind in Brooklyn. Kirsten Potter performs the work.
Eilish was about to explain that she had been sent for, and to ask politely if this was the right time to come, but Miss Kelly's way of looking her up and down made her decide to say nothing. Because of Miss Kelly's manner, Eilish wondered if she had been offended by someone in the town and had mistaken her for that person. "Here you are, then," Miss Kelly said. Eilish noticed a number of black umbrellas resting against the hall stand. "I hear you have no job at all, but a great head for figures."
"Is that right?"
"Oh, the whole town. Anyone who is anyone comes into the shop, and I hear everything." Eilish wondered if this was a reference to her own mother's consistent dealing in another grocery shop, but she was not sure. Miss Kelly's thick glasses made the expression on her face difficult to read. "And we are worked off our feet every Sunday here. Sure, there's nothing else open. And we get all sorts, good, bad, and indifferent. And, as a rule, I open after 7 Mass, and between the end of 9 o'clock Mass until 11 Mass is well over, there isn't room to move in this shop. I have Mary here to help, but she's slow enough at the best of times, so I was on the lookout for someone sharp, someone who would know people and give the right change, but only on Sundays, mind. The rest of the week we can manage ourselves. And you were recommended. I made inquiries about you, and it would be 7 and 6 a week. It might help your mother a bit." Miss Kelly spoke, Eilish thought, as though she were describing a slight done to her, closing her mouth tightly between each phrase. "So that's all I have to say now. You can start on Sunday, but come in tomorrow and learn off all the prices, and we'll show you how to use the scales and the slicer. You'll have to tie your hair back and get a good shop coat in Dan Bolger's or Burke O'Leary's." Eilish was already saving this conversation for her mother and Rose. She wished she could think of something smart to say to Miss Kelly without being openly rude. Instead, she remained silent. "Well?" Miss Kelly asked. Eilish realized that she could not turn down the offer. It would be better than nothing, and, at the moment, she had nothing. "Oh, yes, Miss Kelly," she said. I'll start whenever you like. And on Sunday you can go to 7 o'clock Mass. That's what we do, and we open when it's over.
That's lovely, Eilish said.
So come in tomorrow then, and if I'm busy, I'll send you home. Or you can fill bags of sugar while you wait, but if I'm not busy, I'll show you all the ropes.
Thank you, Miss Kelly, Eilish said.
Your mother'll be pleased that you have something. And your sister, Miss Kelly said. I hear she's great at the golf. So go home now like a good girl. You can let yourself out.
Miss Kelly turned and began to walk slowly up the stairs. Eilish knew as she made her way home that her mother would indeed be happy that she had found some way of making money of her own, but that Rose would think working behind the counter of a grocery shop was not good enough for her. She wondered if Rose would say this to her directly. On her way home, she stopped at the house of her best friend, Nancy Byrne, to find that their friend Annette O'Brien was also there. The Byrnes had only one room downstairs, which served as a kitchen, dining room, and sitting room, and it was clear that Nancy had news of some sort to impart, some of which Annette seemed already to know. Nancy used Eilish's arrival as an excuse to go out for a walk so they could talk in confidence. "Did something happen?" Eilish asked once they were on the street. "Say nothing until we are a mile away from that house," Nancy said. "Mammy knows there's something, but I'm not telling her." They walked down Frary Hill and across the Mill Park Road to the river, and then down along the prom towards the Ringwood.
"She got off with George Sheridan," Annette said.
"When?" Eilish asked.
"At the dance in the Athenaeum on Sunday night," Nancy said.
"I thought you weren't going to go."
"I wasn't, and then I did."
"She danced all night with him," Annette said.
"I didn't, just the last four dances, and then he walked me home. But everybody saw. I'm surprised you haven't heard."
We've just heard Brooklyn by Colm Tóibín. An author who's received international acclaim for his exquisite prose in more than a dozen novels, William Trevor's The Story of Lucy Gault was shortlisted for the prestigious Booker Prize. Indeed, Trevor has special talent for examining the innermost regions of his characters' hearts. The story of Lucy Gault traces the repercussions of a child's attempt to remain in her beloved home. Threatened with a move from Ireland to England, 9-year-old Lucy runs away, setting off a series of misunderstandings that eventually touch each inhabitant of her village. Catherine Borowitz narrates.
There was no other place he might more happily have lived than beneath the slated roof of its three grey stories, the stone softened by the white woodwork of the windows, and the delicate fanlight above a white hall door. Flanking it on its right was the wide, high archway of a cobbled yard, with cobbled passageways leading to an apple orchard and a garden. One half of the circle, onto which the front rooms looked out, was the gravel sweep. The other was a raised lawn that was separated from steeply rising woods by a curve of blue hydrangeas. The upstairs rooms at the back had a view of the sea as far as the sea's horizon. The origins of the Gaults in Ireland had centuries ago misted over, previously of Norfolk, so it was believed within the family, although without much certainty. They had settled first of all in the far western reaches of County Cork. A soldier of fortune had established their modest dynasty, lying low there for reasons that were not known. Sometime in the early 18th century, the family had moved east, respectable and well-to-do by then, one son or another of each generation continuing the family's army connection. The land at Laherdan was purchased. The building of the house began. The long, straight avenue was made, lines of chestnut trees planted along it on either side, the woodlands of the glen laid out. Later generations planted the orchard, with stock from County Armagh. The garden, kept small, was created bit by bit. In 1769, Lord Townsend, the Lord Lieutenant, stayed at Laherdan. In 1809, Daniel O'Connell did, when there wasn't a bedroom unoccupied at the Stuarts, Dromana. History touched the place in that way. But as well remembered, as often talked about, were births and marriages and deaths, domestic incidents, changes and additions to this room or that, occasions of anger or reconciliation. Suffering a stroke, a Gault, in 1847, lay afflicted for 3 years, yet not insensible. There was a disastrous 6 months of card playing in 1872, during which field after field was lost to the neighbouring O'Reillys. There was the diphtheria outbreak that spread so rapidly and so tragically in 1901, sparing only the present Everard Gault and his brother, in a family of five. Above the writing desk in the drawing room, there was a portrait of a distant ancestor whose identity had been unknown for as long as anyone of the present could remember. A spare, solemn countenance where it was not whiskered. Blue, unemphatic eyes. It was the only portrait in the house, although since photography had begun, there were albums that included the images of relatives and friends, as well as those of the Gaults of Laherdan. All this, the house and the remnants of the pasture land, the seashore below the pale clay cliffs, the walk along it to the fishing village of Killoran, the avenue over which the high branches of the chestnut trees now met, was as much part of Everard Gault as the features of his face were, the family traits that quite resembled a few of those in the drawing-room portrait, the smooth, dark hair. Tall and straight-backed, a man who hid nothing of himself, slight in his ambitions now. He had long ago accepted that his destiny was to keep in good heart what had been his inheritance, to attract bees to his hives, to root up his failing apple trees and replace them. He swept the chimneys of his house himself, could repoint its mortar and replace its window glass. Creeping about on its roof, he repaired in the lead the small perforations that occurred from time to time. The secretine he squeezed into them, effective for a while.
That was the story of Lucy Gault by William Trevor. Emma Donoghue was born in Dublin, Ireland. She is the youngest of eight children. Her father, Dennis Donoghue, is a literary critic and the Henry James Professor at NYU. Emma attended Catholic convent schools in Dublin and earned a BA in English and French from University College Dublin. She received a PhD from the University of Cambridge on the concept of friendship between men and women in 18th century English fiction. From age 23, she's earned her living as a writer. She now lives in London, Ontario, with her partner and their young son and daughter. Donoghue's first novel was 1994's Stir Fry, a coming-of-age book about a young Irish woman discovering her sexuality. This was followed in 1995 by Hood, about an Irish woman coming to terms with the death of her girlfriend. Hood won the 97 American Library Association's Gay, Lesbian, and Bisexual Book Award for Literature. Slammerkin was a historical novel set in London and Wales. More novels followed, but it was her 2010 novel Room that became an international bestseller. Room was narrated by a 5-year-old called Jack, who lived in a single room with his ma and had never been outside. Room was shortlisted for the Man Booker and Orange Prize and was one of my favorite books of the year. You'll find the preview on bookreportradio.com, archived shows, week of November 27th, 2010. We'll speak to Emma today about her new work, Astray. Emma, it's so great to have you with us here today at the Book Report.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I want to say from the get-go that Room was probably one of my favorite books of the decade. I loved it.
I'm so glad because, you know, it's not an easy book to delve into at first because it has such an off-putting premise. So I think it's only sold in the numbers it has because individuals have been forcing their friends to read it.
I told everyone they had to pick it up. What was your inspiration for this book, Astray, a collection of stories?
Well, the stories were written one at a time over about 15 years, but they're all about life-changing journeys. So they're all about either emigration from Ireland or Britain to America or Canada, or about long journeys within North America, like, you know, gold miners or prospectors. So I think really what triggered it is that I emigrated twice myself. I left Dublin at 20 and I moved to England for 8 years, and then I moved to Canada. So I've been through this twice now, and I'm sort of fascinated by the subtle ways it changes you to settle in a new place. Even if that's not a tremendously different culture, you still feel slightly off balance, slightly odd, slightly strange, you know?
In Room, readers cared so much for Jack and his mother. You had wonderful pages to build that kind of bond. In Astray, you chose a short story format, so readers perhaps don't have that kind of attachment. How does that affect how you write the book?
You have to move fast with a short story. You have to hook the readers very quickly. Yeah. And often it'll be a strange setting to them, especially if your work is set in previous centuries. So, you know, if it's 18th century New York, I need to hook my readers right away. And sometimes one way to do that is to emphasize the things which still are the same. So, for instance, one of the stories set in 1735 in New York, I start with a kind of a Starbucks moment of my lawyer character sitting in a cafe, having his coffee and watching the world go by and reading the paper, you know. So sometimes you choose to emphasize what's the same rather than what's different. And other times you start with some, you know, peculiarity of the times. But most of all, you want them to care about your characters and to care about things which are completely timeless. And luckily, many of my characters are in life or death situations, because I find that when I'm finding historical moments to write about to do with travel, say, it's never just travel. They're traveling because, you know, a little girl is being fostered out because her mother can't afford to raise her, or, you know, a gang of crooks decide to hold Abraham Lincoln's body to ransom. So, you know, they all have big dramatic reasons to go on their journeys.
I wanted to ask you, I know about the orphan trains through another book that was Laura Moriarty's book, The Chaperone, which is actually about Louise Brooks. But then the heroine, if you will, was put on an orphan train herself. How did you find out about those?
Well, I'm very interested in all the forms of travel which are really life-changing. So not sort of casual tourism, but I'm especially interested in people ending up a long way from home without ever having chosen it. So, for instance, I've got one short story about a German teenager, a boy, sent out by his prince as a mercenary to fight for the British side during the American Revolution. And, you know, even though he was called a mercenary, nobody was paying him. He just about got his dinner. So these kind of helpless moments interest me. And similarly with the orphan trains, as soon as I heard about it, I thought, oh, that's fascinating, the idea that there was this huge kind of migration movement, but none of these people chose to go. They were just shipped off like packages, you know?
Yes, yes.
Tell us more about the Abraham Lincoln story. I never heard about that, and I'm a student of American history.
This crazy gang of counterfeiters, they basically, one of their number, the one who did the really good bogus money, as they called it, he was in jail, and they decided that they could get him out by ransoming him against, you know, swapping him for something really valuable. And they thought they would dig up Abraham Lincoln's body, you know, prize it out of the marble tomb. And they got as far as smashing the tomb open, and then they had to run because they had been infiltrated. So I tell their story from the point of view of the Secret Service man who had infiltrated the group. And I've never done a kind of a classic, you know, quarrels among thieves kind of story before. So I really, with this book, I really enjoyed trying some new genres. Again, I've never done kind of, you know, Western stories to do with the kind of gold mining or cowboy lifestyle. So it was wonderful having to research 14 different mini worlds, you know.
And these are all true stories, based on true stories. So how did you make your selection?
Well, you know, I think I probably found about 40 different ideas, you know, historical incidents that could have been the subject of stories. And then I narrowed it down to 14 in the end because, you know, a historical incident can be interesting, but still not particularly suited to a short story, because sometimes people have written about it perfectly well in a more traditional history form, or sometimes it would be just the incident might be too unrelievedly sad. Sometimes I couldn't find my way in, you know, find a fresh angle on it or any kind of twist. So, you know, not every interesting bit of history makes a good story. So I had to be really selective.
One of the stories is about Caroline, who had a connection to Charles Dickens. Talk about that.
I'm a huge fan of Charles Dickens, and what many people don't know is that he was in his charitable donations, he was very keen on helping women get out of the sex trade. He was very non-judgmental. He thought if somebody wanted to start again and give up being a prostitute, then good luck to her. So this particular woman and her brother, he helped them move to Canada for a fresh start. And what fascinated me about that story was the idea that by moving to another country, you could literally change your name, you know, completely erase your past. And this woman had a small child. And I thought, how interesting that, you know, at the end of the story, you know, once Dickens helped her to move to Canada, she drops off the record. And I'm sure she changed her name. And that's exactly what she wanted. She wanted just to be able to draw a line and say, I'll start all over again somewhere that nobody knows me. So that's one of the great pleasures of emigration. A bit harder to do nowadays with the internet. It's in a way harder to get away from your own history. But I think 100 years ago, yes, it was much more possible to, in a way, have more than one life because you could more easily escape from what people knew about you.
And I was very struck by how poignant the brother-sister relationship was.
Well, one thing I love about using historical sources is that it gives you material that's more sort of rough-edged and odd. So, for instance, if you just chose to write a short story about a woman trying to get out of prostitution, you might think to give her a child, but you wouldn't think to give her a live-in younger brother, you know? Or once when I did a novel about a Victorian divorce case, my novel was called The Sealed Letter. And again, if I'd been just making up a story of a Victorian wife who was adulterous, I would probably have given her one great lover. But this woman was carrying on with two of her husband's colleagues in an overlapping way. And I remember thinking, I would never have made that up. So that's what I love about these real sources. You know, they are genuinely odd.
Innistrad, was there one favorite story that you hold in your heart?
It's hard to choose, but the story I open with, the one about Jumbo the Elephant, I really enjoyed because Jumbo the Elephant is probably the best known character in the book in that he, when the London Zoological Society sold him to Barnum Circus, you know, he became very well known as, you know, the biggest land animal in captivity. But what intrigued me was that he and his captor were incredibly close for about 20 years and his keeper, Matthew Scott, used to literally spend every evening sitting in Jumbo's stall drinking whiskey with the elephant. Not best practices nowadays, but it seemed to work for them. So I decided to tell that story, you know, that my angle in would be to have it spoken by Matthew Scott to Jumbo. So it's a very sort of close, chatty monologue from the man to the elephant. And so that gave me a whole new angle on the Jumbo story.
Well, I have to tell you that in Africa, elephants are known for eating the berries of the amarula tree, which, of course, is a very popular liqueur. So I think, you know, elephants, liqueur, it has happened before.
I know that. That's fascinating.
So what's next for you?
Well, I'm working hard on my next novel, which will be my first crime novel. It's about a murder that happened in San Francisco in 1876. A woman was shot through a window, and the case has never been solved, and I'm fascinated by it. So the story is full of French-speaking lowlifes.
Mm. And it's based on a true story.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, sometimes it's making extra work for me to have to do all this research before I start the books, but I can't help it. I just get hooked by these real stories.
Mm-hmm. And are there talks about Room being made into a film?
Yes, there's a lot of interest, and I'm beginning to talk to filmmakers, and yes, I hope it will happen, because I think this is the one of my books that I can really see working on the screen.
Well, thanks very much, Emma. I mean, I enjoyed reading this book, and I'm thrilled to meet you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And now let's hear a sampling of Estray, performed by an ensemble cast.
I assure you, my boy, I stood up for you. I looked the old man in the watery eye and said, "We all have our off days, but Jumbo's a cleanly, hard-working fellow, as a rule. I have never felt afraid of him for one moment in the 17 years he's been in my care." He muttered something impertinent about that proving my arrogance rather than your safety. "I believe it's gone to your head, Scott." "What has, Superintendent?" "Jumbo's fame. You fancy yourself the cock of the walk." I drew myself up. If I enjoy a certain position in this establishment, if I was awarded a medal back in 66, that is due to having bred, nursed, and reared more exotic animals and birds than any other living man. He pursed his lips. "Not to mention the fortune you pocket from those tuppenny rides." "The nerve! Aren't I the one who helps the kiddies up the ladder? and leads Jumbo round the gardens and makes sure they don't topple off? By rights, the cash should be half yours, lad. But what use would it be to you? You like to mouth the coins with your trunk and slip them into my pocket. The superintendent plucked at his beard. Be that as it may, it's inequitable, bad for morale. You're all charm when it earns you tips, Scott, but flagrantly rude to your superiors in this society, and as for your fellow keepers, they're nervous of saying a word to you these days.
That crew of ignoramus.
I have plenty of conversation, I told him, but I save it for those as appreciate it. They call you a tyrant. Well, I laughed. After all, I'm the 15th child of 17. No silver spoons in my infant mouth. A humble son of toil, who's made good in a precarious profession, and I need apologise to nobody. We don't mind the piddling tiddlers of this world, do we, boy? We just avert our gaze. There's a crate sitting outside on the grass this morning. Pitch pine planking, girded with iron, on a kind of trolley with wheels. Gives me a funny feeling. It's 12 feet high, as near as I can guess. That's just half a foot more than you. Nobody said a word to me about it. Best to mind my own business, I suppose. This place, there's too much gossip and interference already. It'll be time to stretch a leg soon, boy. The kiddies will be lined up outside in their dozens. They missed you yesterday when it was raining. Here, kneel down and we'll get your harder on. Yes, yes, I'll remember to put a double fold of blanket under the corner where it was rubbing. Aren't your toenails looking pearly after that scrub I gave them? There's two men out there by the crate now, setting up some kind of ramp. I don't like the looks of this at all. If this is what I think it is, it's too blooming much. I'm off to the superintendent's office. None of this, please make an appointment. Here's a sack of oats to be getting on with. Oh, don't take on. Hush your bellowing. I'll be back before you miss me.
We've just heard Astray by Emma Donoghue. In the dawning light of morning in August 1974, people in Lower Manhattan stood hushed, staring up at the Twin Towers. A mysterious tightrope walker was running, dancing, and leaping between the towers, suspended a quarter mile above ground. In the streets below, a slew of ordinary lives became extraordinary in Colm McCann's Let the Great World Spin. Corrigan, a radical young Irish monk, struggles with demons as he lives among prostitutes in the burning Bronx. A group of mothers gather in Park Avenue to mourn their sons who died in Vietnam, only to discover just how much divides them even in their grief. A young artist finds herself at the scene of a hit-and-run that sends her own life careening sideways. A 38-year-old grandmother turns tricks along her teenage daughter, but is determined not only to take care of her family, but to prove her own worth. Elegantly weaving together these disparate lives, McCann's book comes alive in the unforgettable voices of the city's people, drawn together by hope, beauty, and the artistic crime of the century. The work is performed by an ensemble cast.
Elbowing for space at the windows of the Woolworth Building. Lawyers, elevator operators, doctors, cleaners, prep chefs, diamond merchants, fish sellers, all of them reassured by the presence of one another. Stenographers, traders, delivery boys, sandwich board men, card sharks, Con Ed, Ma Bell, Wall Street. A locksmith in his van on the corner of Dye and Broadway. A bike messenger lounging against a lamppost on West. A red-faced rummy out looking for an early morning pour. From the Staten Island Ferry, they glimpsed him. From the meatpacking warehouses on the west side. From the new high-rises in Battery Park. From the breakfast carts down on Broadway. From the plaza below. From the towers themselves. Sure, there were some who ignored the fuss, who didn't want to be bothered. It was 7:47 in the morning, and they were too jacked up for anything but a desk, a pen, a telephone. Up they came from the subway stations, from limousines, off city buses, crossing the street at a clip, refusing the prospect of a gawk. Another day, another dolor. But as they passed the little clumps of commotion, they began to slow down. Some stopped altogether, shrugged, turned nonchalantly, walked to the corner, bumped up against the watchers, went to the tips of their toes, gazed over the crowd, and then introduced themselves with a wow, or a gee whiz. The man above remained rigid, and yet his mystery was mobile. He stood beyond the railing of the observation deck of the South Tower. At any moment he might just take off. Below him, a single pigeon swooped down from the top floor of the Federal Office Building, as if anticipating the fall. The movement caught the eyes of some watchers, and they followed the gray flap against the small of the standing man. The bird shot from one eave to another, and it was then the watchers noticed that they had been joined by others at the windows of offices, where blinds were being lifted and a few glass panes labored upward. All that could be seen was a pair of elbows, or the end of a shirt sleeve, or an arm garter. But then it was joined by a head, or an odd-looking pair of hands above it, lifting the frame even higher. In the windows of nearby skyscrapers, figures came to look out. Men in shirt sleeves and women in bright blouses, wavering in the glass like funhouse apparitions. Higher still, a weather helicopter executed a dipping turn over the Hudson, a curtsy to the fact that the summer day was going to be cloudy and cool anyway, and the rotors beat a rhythm over the warehouses of the west side. At first, the helicopter looked lopsided in its advance, and a small side window was slid open as if the machine were looking for air. A lens appeared in the open window. It caught a brief flash of light. After a moment, the helicopter corrected beautifully and spun across the expanse. Some cops on the West Side Highway switched on their misery lights, swerved fast off the exit ramps, making the morning all the more magnetic. A charge entered the air all around the watchers, and now that the day had been made official by sirens, there was a chatter among them, their balance set on edge, their calm fading. And they turned to one another and began to speculate. Would he jump? Would he fall? Would he tiptoe along the ledge? Did he work there? Was he solitary? Was he a decoy? Was he wearing a uniform? Did anyone have binoculars? Perfect strangers touched one another on the elbows. Swear words went between them, and whispers that there'd been a botched robbery, that he was some sort of cat burglar, that he'd taken hostages. He was an Arab, a Jew, a Cypriot, an IRA man. That he was really just a publicity stunt, a corporate scam. Drink more Coca-Cola, eat more Fritos, smoke more Parliaments, spray more Lysol, love more Jesus.
That was Let the Great World Spin by Colin McCann. Sebastian Barry's work has twice been shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. Now, on Canaan's Side, the talented author tells the tale of 20th century America. The story begins as Lily mourns the loss of her grandson. She revisits her past, going back to the moment she was forced to flee Ireland at the end of World War I. Her tale continues in America, a world filled with hope and danger. At once epic and intimate, Lily's story unfolds as she tries to make sense of the sorrows and troubles of her life and of the people whose lives she's touched. Spanning nearly seven decades, this is the story of a woman whose capability to love is enormous and whose compassion, even for those who've wronged her, is astonishing. Wanda McCadden narrates.
The legend of my mother was that she died in giving birth to me. I broke free, my father said, like a pheasant from cover, noisily. His own father had been steward of Humewood Estate in Wicklow, so he knew what a pheasant looked like breaking from cover. My mother died just as the need for candlelight failed at the first instance of the dawn. It was in Dawkey Village, not far from the sea. For many years that was just a story to me. But when I was pregnant with my own child, it suddenly became vivid, and as if it was present time. I sensed her in that cramped delivery room in Cleveland as I strained to get him out. I never had any true thought of my mother till then, and yet in those moments I do not think any human being was ever closer to another. When the baby was laid on my breast at last, me panting like an animal, and that matchless happiness surged through me, I cried for her, and the worth and weight of those tears was more to me than a kingdom. When I was shown the Catholic Catechism at 4 in the little infant school attached to the castle, and the very first question was posed, "Who made the world?" I knew in my heart that the teacher, Mrs. O'Toole, erred in providing the answer, God. She stood before us and read out the question and answer in her wren-sized voice. And I might have been inclined to believe her, because she was impressive to me at 4, in her skirt as grey as a seal in Dublin Zoo, and she had been very kind to me as I came in, and had given me an apple. But the world, as I thought she ought to have known, was made by my father, James Patrick Dunn, not quite at that time, but later to be chief superintendent of the Dublin Metropolitan Police. The legend of my father was that he had led the charge against Larkin's men in Sackville Street. When Larkin came over O'Connell Bridge in a fake beard and moustache and walked up through the marble corridors of the Imperial Hotel and out onto a balcony and began to give a speech to the hundreds of workers gathered below, which had been forbidden by edict, my father and the other officers ordered the waiting constables forward with batons drawn. When I first was told this story as a child, on the very evening it happened, I misunderstood and thought my father had done something heroic. I added, in my imagination, a white horse upon which he rode with ceremonial sword drawn. I saw him rush forward like in a proper cavalry charge. I gasped at his chivalry and courage. It was only years later I understood that he had advanced on foot, and that 3 of the working men had been killed. Old matters, and not much to do with the grief of the present, except it gives me my bearings. Now I'll draw breath and start properly. When I came back in from the funeral, my friend Mr. Dillinger had come into the hallway while I was out, and left flowers but not waited for me. They were very costly flowers, and he'd put a little note against them and written, "To my dear friend Mrs. Beer in the time of her great loss." It touched me truly. I'm sure if Mr. Nolan was still alive, he also would have crept in, but it would not have been welcome. Maybe if I didn't know what I know now, maybe if Mr. Nolan's death had not occurred when it did, I might have gone on imagining him my closest friend in life. It is so strange that his death and the death of my grandson, Bill, have happened so close together in time. All things come in threes, no doubt this is true. The third death will be my own. I'm 89 years old and will end my life very shortly. How can I live without Bill?
That was a preview of On Canaan's Side by Sebastian Barry. Before becoming a full-time writer, John Connolly worked as a barman, a local government official, even a gopher at Harrods. After 5 years as a freelance journalist for the Irish Times, Connolly began to write his first novel, Every Dead Thing, in his spare time. That book introduced readers to the anti-hero Charlie Parker, a former police officer hunting the killer of his wife and daughter. The book was met with critical acclaim and was nominated for many awards. In Whisperers, book 9 of the Charlie Parker series, Connolly takes us to the border between Maine and Canada. There, in the vast North Woods, a dangerous smuggling operation is taking place, run by a group of disenchanted former soldiers newly returned from Iraq. Illicit goods, drugs, cash, weapons, even people are changing hands. And something else has changed hands, something ancient and powerful and evil. The authorities suspect something is amiss, and Parker begins to investigate. The smugglers are beginning to die one after the other in apparent suicides. The soldiers' actions have attracted the attention of the reclusive Herod, a man with a taste for the strange. And where Herod goes, so goes a shadowy figure called the Captain. To defeat them, Parker must form an uneasy alliance with a man he fears more than any other, the killer known as the Collector. Holter Graham narrates.
The fighting had then spread to the television station, less than a kilometer away, and to the central bus station at the other side of the complex, drawing closer and closer to them. He had argued in favor of staying, for they had stockpiled food and water in the basement, but many of the others felt that the risks were too great. All but one of the guards had fled, abandoning their weapons and their uniforms, and there were already black-garbed gunmen in the museum garden. So they had locked the front doors and left through the back entrance before fleeing across the river to the eastern side, where they waited in the house of a colleague for the fighting to cease. But it did not stop. When they attempted to return over the bridge of the medical city, they were turned back, and so they stayed with their colleague once again and drank coffee and waited some more. Perhaps they had remained there for too long, debating back and forth the wisdom of abandoning what was for now a place of safety. But what else could they have done? Yet he could not forgive himself or assuage his guilt. He had abandoned her, and they had had their way with her. And now he was crying, not from the dirt and filth, but from rage and hurt and loss. He did not stop, not even as booted feet approached him and a soldier shone a flashlight in his face. There were others behind him, their weapons raised. "Sir, who are you?" asked the soldier. Dr. Aldini did not reply. He could not. All his attention was fixed on the eyes of the broken girl. "Sir, do you speak English? I'll ask you one more time, who are you?" Dr. Aldini picked up on the nervousness in the soldier's voice, but also the hint of arrogance, the natural superiority of the conqueror over the conquered. He sighed and raised his eyes.
"My name is Dr. Mufid Aldini," he said, "and I am the deputy curator of Roman antiquities at this museum."
Then he reconsidered.
"No, I was the deputy curator of Roman antiquities. But now there is no museum left. Now there are only fragments. You let this happen. You stood by and let this happen."
But he was speaking as much to himself as he was to them, and the words turned to ash in his mouth. The staff had left the museum on Tuesday. On Saturday, they learned that the museum had been looted, and then began to return in an effort to assess the damage and prevent any further theft. Someone said that the looting had commenced as early as Thursday, when hundreds of people had gathered at the fence surrounding the museum. For 2 days, they were free to ransack. Already, there were rumors that insiders had been involved, some of the museum's own guardians targeting the most valuable artifacts. The thieves took everything that could be moved, and much of what they could not take, they attempted to destroy. Dr. Aldini and some others had gone to the headquarters of the Marines and pleaded for help in securing the building, for the staff was fearful that the looters would return, and the U.S. Army tanks at the intersection only 50 meters from the museum had refused to come to their aid, citing orders. They were eventually promised guards by the Americans, but only now, on Wednesday, had they come. Dr. Aldini had arrived just shortly before them, for he had been one of those assigned the role of liaison with the soldiers and the media, and he had spent the previous days being passed up and down the military ranks and providing contacts for journalists. Carefully, he raised the head of the broken girl, youthful yet ancient, the paint still visible on her hair and mouth and eyes, after almost 4,000 years.
"Look,"
he said, still weeping.
"Look at what they did to her."
And the soldiers stared for a moment at this old man covered in white dust, a hollow head in his hands, before moving on to secure the looted halls of the Iraq Museum. They were young men, and this operation was about the future, not the past. No lives had been lost, not here. These things happened. After all, there was a war on.
That was Whisperers by John Connolly. It started in 1845 and lasted 6 years. Before it was over, more than 1 million men, women, and children starved to death, and another million fled the country. Measured in terms of mortality, the Great Irish Potato Famine was one of the worst disasters of the 19th century, claiming twice as many lives as the American Civil War. The Great Famine was a perfect storm of bacterial infection, political greed, and religious intolerance. In The Graves Are Walking, The Great Famine and the Saga of the Irish People, John Kelly provides fascinating new research and analysis on the famine's causes and consequences. Gerard Doyle narrates.
In the countryside, packs of feral dogs dog up the graves of the famine dead. In the cities, shoeless pauper women with dead infants in their arms stood on street corners begging. Along the coasts, men and women scaled 300-foot cliffs in winter cold and wind in search of seagull eggs, or scoured the January tideline for seaweed. In the pestilential hospitals and workhouses, the weekly death rate rose into the thousands. In the crowded port towns, emigrants fought each other for space on the teeming docks. After more than 2 years of famine, people were no longer leaving Ireland. They were fleeing, the way a crowd flees a burning building, heedlessly, recklessly, on ships that had no business on any ocean, let alone a January ocean. And often they fled in defiance of the family bonds for which the Irish were justly famous. In the overpowering desire to get out, husbands deserted wives, parents, children, brothers, sisters, brothers. The emigrants of this year are not like those of former years, the Cork Examiner declared in March 1847. They are now actually running away. Ask any emigrant his destination that March, and he would have replied, anywhere that wasn't Ireland. Among those too old, too young, too poor, sick or frightened to leave, the ubiquity of death had compressed life to two simple wishes, an unmolested grave and a coffin to be buried in. Terry Eagleton, a former professor of literature at Oxford, has called the Irish famine the greatest social disaster of 19th-century Europe, an event with something of the characteristics of a low-level nuclear attack. In terms of the famine's impact on Irish demography, that is a fair assessment. Between 1845 and 1855, the period that encompasses the crisis years of 1845 to 1847 and their immediate aftermath, the Irish population of almost 8.2 million shrank by a third. Starvation and disease killed 1.1 million. Emigration claimed another 2 million. On an absolute basis, the numbers pale in comparison to the 30 million Chinese who died in the Great Leap Forward famine of the early 1960s and the 7 million who perished in the Ukrainian famine of the early 1930s. But Mao Zedong's China and Joseph Stalin's Soviet Union were large populous nations able to sustain catastrophic mortalities. Ireland was not. At the end of the famine, one out of every three people was gone, and the survivors felt as stunned and bewildered by the scale of the loss as the Italian poet Petrarch did after the Black Death. Where are our dear friends now? What lightning bolt devoured them? What earthquake toppled them? What tempest drowned them? There was a crowd of us. Now we are almost alone. What made the famine so devastating? The role of simple bad luck cannot be ignored. Had the potato failed two generations earlier, when Ireland had a lower rate of potato dependency, or two generations later, when the economy was on a sounder footing, the demographic impact might have been less severe. But the potato failed in the mid-1840s, when a generation-long collapse in peasant living standards had made the bottom two-thirds of the nation solely, or almost solely, reliant on the potato, and Ireland had not yet developed the physical, commercial, and human infrastructure needed to cope with a major catastrophe. There were not enough food stores in rural areas to feed the suddenly potatoless peasantry, not enough mills to process the hundreds of thousands of tons of provisions that had to be imported to replace the lost potatoes, not enough physicians to cope with the historic pestilence that broke out in the midst of the famine, and not enough engineers, administrators, or other trained personnel to organize and manage an efficient relief effort. A modern example of the difference such resources can make in a national crisis is the contrasting experiences of Haiti, a country with an undeveloped infrastructure, where in 2010 an earthquake of magnitude 7.0 killed as many as 85,000, and Japan, a sophisticated and resource-rich country, where in 2011 an earthquake of 9.0 magnitude, a tsunami and a nuclear meltdown produced a death toll of under 25,000. In 1845, when Phytophthora infestans, the fungus that caused the crop failures, appeared for the first time, Ireland was Haiti.
We've just heard The Graves Are Walking by John Kelly. A Faithful Place is Tanya French's third novel featuring the Dublin Murder Squad. As the book opens, 19-year-old Frank McKee is waiting in vain for Rosie. They're set to run away to London together. When she doesn't show, Frank leaves Dublin without her, thinking never to return. Years later, Rosie's suitcase is found in an abandoned house, and Frank, now a detective, returns to learn the truth of that long-ago night. Tim Gerard Reynolds narrates.
My father once told me that the most important thing every man should know is what he would die for. If you don't know that, he said, what are you worth? Nothing. You're not a man at all. I was 13, and he was 3/4 of a way into a bottle of Gordon's Finest, but hey, good talk. As far as I recall, he was willing to die A, for Ireland, B, for his mother, who had been dead for 10 years, and C, to get that bitch Maggie Thatcher. All the same, at any moment of my life since that day, I could have told you straight off the bat exactly what I would die for. At first it was easy. My family, my girl, my home. Later, for a while, things got more complicated. These days they hold steady, and I like that. It feels like something a man can be proud of. I would die for, in no particular order, my city, my job, and my kid. The kid is well behaved so far. The city is Dublin, and the job is on the undercover squad, so it may sound obvious which one I'm most likely to wind up dying for, but it's been a while since work handed me anything scarier than a paperwork megaturd. The size of this country means a field agent's shelf life is short. 2 ops, maybe 4, and your risk of being spotted gets too high. I used up my 9 lives a long time back. I stay behind the scenes, for now, and run operations of my own. Here's the real risk in undercover. In the field and out. You create illusions for long enough, you start thinking you're in control. It's easy to slide into believing you're the hypnotist here, the mirage master, the smart cookie who knows what's real and how all the tricks are done. The fact is, you're still just another slack-jawed mark in the audience, no matter how good you are. This world is always going to be better at this game. It's more cunning than you are. It's faster. And it's a whole lot more ruthless. All you can do is try to keep up, know your weak spots, and never stop expecting the sucker punch. The second time my life geared up for the sucker punch, it was a Friday afternoon at the beginning of December. I'd spent the day doing maintenance work on some of my current Mirages. One of my boys, who would not be getting any cookies from Uncle Frank in his Christmas stocking, had got himself into a situation wherein, for complex reasons, he needed an elderly lady whom he could introduce to several low-level drug dealers as his granny.
That was A Faithful Place by Tanya French. A Week in Winter is the final book from the wonderful Maeve Binchy, beloved Irish author who recently passed away. This story is set in Stonybridge, a small town on the west coast of Ireland. When Chicky Starr decides to take an old decaying mansion and turn it into a lodge, everyone thinks she's crazy. But with lots of help, she creates a warm, welcoming place. The first guests arrive, and an unlikely cast of characters they are, but a group that makes for Binchy's trademark grand storytelling. Rosalind Landor narrates.
Walter Starr lived in a world where everything was simple. They loved each other, so what was more natural than to make love? They each knew the other was right, so why complicate their lives by fretting over what other people would say or think or do? A kindly God understood love. Father Johnson, who had taken a vow never to fall in love, didn't. They didn't need any stupid contracts or certificates, did they? And after 6 glorious weeks, when Walter had to think of going back to the States, Chicky was ready to go with him. It involved an immense amount of rows and dramas and enormous upset in the Ryan household, but Walter was unaware of any of this. Chicky's father was more worried than ever now, because everyone would say that he had brought up a tramp who was no better than she should be. Chicky's mother looked more tired and disappointed than ever, and said only God and his sainted mother knew what she had done wrong in bringing Chicky up to be such a scourge to them all. Kathleen said that it was just as well she had an engagement ring on her finger, because no man would have her if he knew the kind of family she came from. Mary, who worked in the insurance office and was walking out with one of the O'Haras, said that the days of her romance were now numbered, thanks to Chicky. The O'Haras were a very respectable family in the town, and they wouldn't think kindly about this behaviour at all. Her brother Brian kept his head down and said nothing at all. When Chicky asked him what he thought, Brian said he didn't think. He didn't have time to think. Chicky's friends, Peggy, who also worked in the knitting factory, and Nuala, who was a maid for the 3 Miss Sheedys, said it was the most exciting, reckless thing they had ever heard of, and wasn't it great that she had a passport already from that school trip to Lourdes? Walter Starr said they would stay in New York with friends of his. He was going to drop out of law school. It wasn't really right for him. If we had several lives, well, then yes, maybe. But since we only have one life, it wasn't worth spending it studying law. The night before she left, Chicky tried to make her parents understand her feelings. She was 20. She had her whole life to live. She wanted to love her family, and for them to love her in spite of their disappointment. Her father's face was tight and hard. She would never be welcome in this house again. She had brought shame on them all. Her mother was bitter. She said that Chicky was being very, very foolish. It wouldn't last. It couldn't last. It was not love. It was infatuation. If this Walter really loved her, then he would wait for her and provide her with a home and his name and a future instead of all this nonsense. You could cut the atmosphere in the Ryan household with a knife. Chicky's sisters were no support, but she was adamant. They hadn't known real love. She was not going to change her plans. She had her passport. She was going to go to America. "Wish me well," she had begged them the night before she left, but they had turned their faces away. "Don't let me go away with the memory of you being so cold." Chicky had tears running down her face. Her mother sighed a great sigh. "It would be cold if we just said, 'Go ahead, enjoy yourself. We are trying to do our best for you, to help you make the best of your life. This is not love. It's only some sort of infatuation. There's no use pretending. You can't have our blessing. It's just not there for you.'" So Chicky left without it. At Shannon Airport, there were crowds waving goodbye to their children, setting out for a new life in the United States. There was nobody to wave Chicky goodbye, but she and Walter didn't care. They had their whole life ahead of them.
We've just heard A Week in Winter by Maeve Binchy. To quote an old Irish blessing, for each petal on the shamrock, this brings a wish your way. Good health, good luck, and happiness for today and every day. Readers, I hope you've enjoyed our literary visit to Ireland. For more choices from every corner of the globe, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.